if we make a difference locally, we can see that difference. And one of the big issues we have with the climate crisis and the social crisis, particularly climate, is that there are no immediate feedback loops. So I go out and I recycle every day. Climate change is still happening. You know, that you can't see how you're making a difference. So there's something really interesting. It's almost like we're being forced down a different route as entrepreneurs, I would argue, that is very exciting and that leads to this idea of a regenerative society or economy.
Louise Kellerup Roper is my guest on this episode of Inside Ideas, brought to you by 1.5 Media, Innovators Magazine, and sponsored by the Alohas Regenerative Foundation. Louise is the CEO of Volans. She leads the team and is responsible for Volans' entire mission, programs, and strategy, and ensuring Volans has the biggest possible positive impact through what we do and how they work with anyone everywhere. After leaving her native Denmark to study PPE at the University of Oxford, Louise started her career with leading-edge software companies such as Cisco and Checkpoint Software Technologies before focusing in on the role of business for good, launching Cradle to Cradle and B-Lab pioneering companies like Method and G Diapers into Europe and bringing circular economy business models and scale to ambitious small businesses. Louise is a guest lecturer at both Cranfield University and the University of Exeter and part of the Ellen MacArthur Foundation's CE100 network. She also mentors young changemakers via the Aspire Foundation and the Aspire Trailblazing Women's Network. Now, with Cradle to Cradle, that's William McDonough, Bill McDonough, one of my good friends, my mentors. He's also an architect on one of my projects and his companies. And happened to be that Michael Braungart is actually at the Leuphana University here in Hamburg, where I live. And so it's wonderful to see your connections to those. And I'm sure there's a lot of cross-cutting friends and acquaintances that we have over the years. But Louise, welcome to the show. I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you, Mark. It's really good to be here. It took a little while to organize, huh? But yeah, no, it's great to be here. And it's actually, as you're reading that out, the Cradle to Cradle piece has been really important. And I sometimes think we don't talk about Michael and Bill enough, because they've really created a systems change that I don't think anybody had anticipated with the book, with the movement. And then, as Mike would say, letting the anarchy begin and letting people own it and push it out into the world. I think they're amazing leaders in systems change, really.
Absolutely, they are. And it's crazy what a small world we find ourselves in. A lot of cross-cutting acquaintances and people that we work with, these sustainability movements, these circular economy movements are, believe it or not, pretty small, even though it sounds, world-changing, very large movements. They're actually pretty small groups and everybody's kind of connected. And we're just trying to get the word out of there. How, with your involvement with Ellen MacArthur Foundation and CE100, Bill McDonough basically kind of led the way on the whole circular economy. I mean, Cradle to Cradle is very circular in concept, and I think a lot of that came with that. How is that going? How have you found that development, and why do you think we're not talking about it enough?
Yes, absolutely. Cradle to Cradle was the foundation of circular economy. And I think the Ellen MacArthur Foundation did a great job of saying, oh, we can take this and actually commercialize it a little bit more and make it understandable and create a network of companies that could learn about this, which I was really lucky to be involved in quite early when they started. And I don't think we're talking about it enough because it's complicated. And because there is, in this very small community really of change makers and sustainability type people like you and I, there is a hesitancy sometimes to push an agenda onto normal conversations. And to start explaining, oh, this is the circular economy. People say, well, you mean recycling then? Is almost the first ever, you know, it's like, well, no. Circular means that you are designing something with a systems lens so that it can be reused. But yeah, I'm amazed at how many intelligent people who are not in this space don't really talk about it or know what it is. So I think there's still a huge job of communicating. I think the last time I heard from Andrew at the EMF, he said that about less than 10% of the economy is worldwide is still circular. So we've got a little while to go.
A long while. They just came out with Ellen MacArthur Foundation just came out with Circuletics. It's kind of an analytic system, and I've had a couple of great people from them on as well talking about this. So there's constantly new reports, new data, analytics, and tools that are out there to spread the word. But I'm finding the exact same thing. We're not talking about enough. There's not enough understanding. I advise a couple companies out of Israel, but they really want to take care of all their scope 1, 2, and 3, take care of their reporting. They want to do recycling. They want to make sure that they, as an organization, are structured in a way that's good. There's no recycling in all of Israel. It's all cradle to grave. And I'm running into this more and more. And the reason I'm bringing it up, I kind of want to see how you're running it. You guys advise numerous companies out there that we have these great innovators, these great startups, great companies that really want to start out on the very first foot or the beginning of what they do in a very sustainable, environmentally friendly way. They come up with super innovations, but now as they go to scale and get to market and apply those, they're realizing that infrastructure is not even there. The policy, the laws, the labeling, the infrastructure to get it to scale or to kind of convert it, that's not even there. And now they're having to be lawmakers, policymakers. They have to create the infrastructure. They have to create the recycling system in their whole community. This the same company as well, they had to create a whole type of electric bus system just for transport to kind of have a sustainable way to get to work and back.
That's exactly it. And funnily enough, what you're describing is actually the reason why I went from working with two, so cradle to cradle product companies, so Method products, so the soaps and so on. And one of the issues we had when we introduced the refills for the laundry detergent into Europe was it wasn't recyclable, the stuff in the system, in the European system. So had to create our own, literally our own way of getting the materials back. And then what were we going to do with them? And so you end up, and that is seriously the story that took me from cradle to cradle into circular economy, because it was so obvious. You had to think about the whole system. And similarly with G diapers, diapers, nappies that compost in the soil within 3 months. Most nappies never disappear because they're full of plastic. Yeah, so you could in theory put them in, I live in London, so you could put them in the food recycling bin and they would actually be good for the composting there. But I couldn't. I couldn't convince the council to allow that to happen because of the risk of contamination. So that means you have these beautiful products invented that are just as bad, let's be honest, or close to as bad for the environment effectively, because there's no system to make use of the attributes, the cradle-to-cradle attributes or the circular potential. And so it means that entrepreneurs now, I think there has been a huge shift from, oh, you can create this and isn't it great and rely on policy, et cetera, to having to think differently about scale and think, well, maybe if I could in this area get a local change in the policy or convince or whatever, work with a local ecosystem to make something work, whether it's recycling or something else that can make the product at its, you know, perform at its best for the world. So you have to do that locally and then replicate rather than think, oh yeah, we're going to just scale this up, which has been this model for years and years. You know, you, if you're a startup, what you need to do is scale as fast as you can and sell. Like, you know, that has been the model. So, so it's interesting. And in a way, it's a different challenge for entrepreneurs, but it's also, there's something really good about it because that is where we have to go. We have to stop thinking that everything is about efficiency and scale and look at quality. And somebody used the word proximity the other day, which I love. It's like, we have to think about the proximity of our products to the, you know, to the local community, to the local environment. And we can then overcome a different problem for climate change and social change, which is we get much better feedback loops. If we make a difference locally, we can see that difference. And one of the big issues we have with the climate crisis and the social crisis, particularly climate, is that there are no immediate feedback loops. You know, so I go out and I recycle every day. Climate change is still happening. You know, they, you can't see how you're making a difference. So there's something really interesting. And it's almost like we're being forced down a different route as entrepreneurs, I would argue, that that is very exciting and that leads to this idea of a regenerative society or economy that which is what, you know, we at Volans are working for all the time. It's trying to nudge those conditions in the right direction.
Yeah. And I mean, I agree. We don't see those feedback loops quick enough, but what we do see if the products are done right is that it doesn't go cradle to grave. You never see your products in the graveyard or in the landfill or somewhere laying on a curb or in the oceans or somewhere where it comes back because you've pre-thought of that. Where's it going? Where's it going to end up? How's it going to come back to me? How can we keep it in that technical cycle or that organic cycle and keep it in kind of a closed system? Now, I feel in some respects for those who maybe are unaware of Volans that we might have gotten ahead of ourselves. And I have to caveat, even though we know each other, maybe there are some listeners that are out there who are like, Volans and Cradle to Cradle and Ellen MacArthur and what is it? You are the CEO of Volans, and which is affiliated with John Elkington. It's an organization that really has regenerators. It's really advising businesses and everyone. You could probably tell us better than I can to push transformations, to push training, education, to get people thinking about the topics that we've already jumped into in advance to prepare them to be better businesses for good, to prepare them to think of a lot of things. And it's really a lot under the guise of, you know, this is one of John's latest books, Green Swans, where he talks about the recall of the triple bottom line, which he did in 2018, which was a 25-year process, or it was around for 25 years before he recalled it. And so I want you to tell us a little bit more about Volans and about that mission, a little bit about the regenerators, and then I want to go in to this recall in 2018 of the triple bottom line and kind of go a little bit more, because with a recall, there should always be something that replaces or fixes that recall. We want a little bit more history there.
Okay, I can do that. It's all beautifully linked. Thank you. So yes, Volans, I'm the CEO. I joined in 2017, so 5 years ago. It was founded by John in 2008. And a couple of his colleagues from his old company, Sustainability, as well as someone who was very senior at the World Economic Forum and the Schwab Foundation, Pamela. So they founded it, and we still have, to a large degree, the same mission, which is about catalyzing systemic change. The way we do that tends to be through businesses. We work with other organizations and straight businesses, but mostly through business. And we do two things. One is we have a sort of think tank work stream, which tries to look further into the future than any sensible business should, to look at what's coming and start thinking about that, which is always interesting. So we had fun with, did a big piece for the World Business Council for Sustainable Development, which came out October 2019, which was 10 big disruptors: 1, economic crisis; 2, risk of war; 3, global pandemic, et cetera, et cetera. So those kinds of things, not very, very deep research, but synthesizing and looking at disruptions and what's coming, trends. And then the other piece, which is closely linked, they're not separate at all, is we then work with ambitious businesses to help them think through what that means and get on the front foot in their personal transfer or sort of organizational transformation to create the system that's needed for them both to be successful, but more than that, to have a world that's going to exist for further generations. So that's the whole piece of it. It sort of links together. So the work we do, we test it with clients, some of our thinking, we learn from doing things in practice, and then we feed it back. I always say that we have 3 kind of pillars. One is we're always based on research and insight. Secondly, our approach, and I think that's what distinguishes us from others, is very creative and very focused on humans, on unlocking the insights that are within an organization. And really, we've got some fantastic tools and processes we run with, which are fun. And then the third piece is that we try and be really practical in our application. So we do books, we do reports and so on, but really most of the work is kind of under the radar in that it's practical work for organizations. And there's a lot of it. My thesis has been for a few years that every single company, however good it looks on the outside, is in need of a bigger transformation than we can even imagine. Even Volans, even though I've set it up in to create a regenerative conditions for my team and for our clients, there is transformation needed across the board. So it's quite fun, and we have to pick very carefully. We're very small. We're based in London, but we work globally. So we try and pick things that A, have that potential for systemic change, that is regenerative, and that it's people that we can work with and we really like, which always surprises people. Like, well, surely you have clients you don't like. And we really don't. I genuinely think they're all marvelous people, because we can't do this difficult work and look into the future and take a whole organization with us if there isn't mutual respect, trust, and fun.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, times are too tough to not have fun at work, it would be my view. So
that's absolutely beautiful. And I know you guys before we get to the triple bottom line and kind of that, you guys have really worked with the who's of organizations. And you, although we spoke before and you said, you know, I haven't read that book or I haven't read that, you guys read a lot and you read a lot of reports. You're involved in a lot of front running things. I know John just had, not too long ago, a podcast with the founder of Patagonia, and, the new announcement that just amazing, came out there. It was amazing things. And so, and I could go on and on. You have a fellow, Daniel Christian Wall, designing regenerative cultures. Yes. And he's now a part of the fellow of you guys. And the other accolade that I really have to mention is that you guys received the B Corp Best for the World Governance recognition, which is not only do you do the work, you have the podcast, you're connected, but you're also receiving the accolades and the recognition as being a front runner in the thought leaders and this think tank movement of what's going on. And John has been doing this a long time. And has made it a little bit easier, the path that has went there to set up everything and his connections and that. But it's just trying to get humanity on the right side of history, and businesses especially, what can we do? And so I am astounded every time I see what you guys are doing and who's there. And we'll talk a little bit more about that, but it's all kind of led up to this thought leader, this front runner in the triple bottom line that then in 2018 was recalled. And I know that you have a strategy or a plan that was there. And I found it, but I think some others might be hard pressed to have seen that in the past. So.
Right. Yeah. No, we haven't actually published that much in detail on it. It's mentioned in John's book from 2020, the Green Swans book, but really it all came out of inquiry. One of these thought leadership projects we took on, which we were lucky enough to get sponsored by Unilever, Aviva, The Body Shop, Covestro, and a couple of others. And the question we asked ourselves was, what will it take for businesses to catalyze systemic change? How can a business become a catalyst? And there were lots of conclusions, and I'll touch on some of them. And one of the things that we, as we dug into this, because John had coined this term, the triple bottom line, people, planet, and profit, 25 or 24 years actually earlier when we started the project, we also looked at that, because that has been, and now it's sort of reflected in the ESG piece, right? Environmental, social, and governance. And the triple bottom line had set off this movement within sustainability around reporting on the impact, not just profit, but reporting on social impact, reporting on environmental impact. And that was all great. But when we looked at it as a tool for catalyzing bigger systemic change, which is what's needed now, it wasn't really doing what it should have done, what, you know, John had intended it to do. It was being traded off, people saying, yeah, we'll have profit, and then we won't do any harm to the environment, but we'll really focus on our social aspect. Or sort of, rather than looking at it as three things that really must work together. And so partly, and this, you know, it signals some of the playfulness, I guess, that we have in our work. This recall came out. And through the Harvard Business Review, there was an article where John said, well, I'm going to try and do a product recall because this isn't working for the world. Let's take it back. And it was astounding, the response, actually. I saw one woman who heard it live in a conference, started crying because she'd built her whole life and her whole career around the triple bottom line and people, planet, profit. And it was this shock. And John, well, how could you do this? But really what we discovered was that there's nothing wrong with the triple bottom line as a systemic tool, but you have to use it in a bigger way than how it was being used. And maybe I can explain. So we now talk about it as it has highlighting the three R's. The three R's are responsibility, resilience, and regeneration. And most companies really have focused on being responsible, being good companies. And they're the ones who've used the triple bottom line. Minimizing negative impact is how it had been used, which is great. And it's great. We have so much more data and transparency from businesses than we had 30 years ago before the triple bottom line came into play and all the reporting. You know, we've now got so many EU directives and US laws now, and in the UK the same, that are pushing reporting and pushing this transparency so we can make real choices, which we didn't have before. So it's great. Responsibility is fine. However, it doesn't, as we've seen and we saw strongly, it was interesting, strongly during COVID and the whole pandemic and now in this crisis, it doesn't make you for a resilient company, because we've might have just slowed down the damage we've done both to society and the environment by treating the triple bottom line in that way. And actually reminds me of a quote from, now we talked about Cradle to Cradle, the Cradle to Cradle book opens with a quote about sustainability not being good enough, because you're just slowing down your drive to the cliff edge of the world.
And you're basically just drive, you're still heading in the wrong direction. You're just exactly, going slower.
Exactly, yeah. That. And it was a little bit of that. And responsibility is a bit like that. You know, we'll just slow it down and we'll do better than we did last year. And really good companies would, you know, pick up on like the Future Fit Foundation's benchmark and say, oh, we're not benchmarking against our industry or ourselves we're benchmarking against the future, and yet still too slow, let's be honest. And then, so when you then look at, okay, so we're going to be resilient. So resilient, the mindset of that really is, let's then protect ourselves against these awful climate or social disasters. Let's have a great diversity policy let's onshore our supply chain so we're not so affected by what's going on if Asia burns. Or, you know, that's the resilience mindset. It's still this mindset that companies and business and humans are in one place, and then we've got an external nature, an external environment or biosphere, an external society. And the resilience has the same output, but it's trying to just protect ourselves. So not do less damage to the weather, that's the responsibility. Then you've got the resilience. And I see them, by the way, as stacked, so that you have to have one and then the other. The only way we discovered through our work to really have a resilient business is to shift that mindset and to look for regeneration. And the reason why that's a qualitatively different mindset is you are accepting that you are part of the system, that the business, the organization, the human beings are part of environment and part of society. It's not something external that you can damage or not damage, because if that is damaged, you are damaged. So we then really started digging into this. What does that mean, that regenerative piece? And really it means that the financial, we've come back to the profit, the value creation under the line of profit has to be directly and inextricably linked to the value creation for the environmental system and the social system. Buy one pair of shoes and I'm going to buy some shoes for somebody in Africa. That's not an inextricable link. Your business models have to be set up so that the systems win and that everybody, you know, and you win. And that's really different. So that for me and for our clients has been a real, really interesting play, because it's still hard. We are so used to seeing externalities, to seeing this outside businesses here. We've got some stakeholders out there somewhere and we can be nice to them or not. Breaking that open and seeing businesses within a system is very, very different. So those are the three R's. I hope that was a clear enough explanation.
That's perfect. Yeah. But there's been a little bit more progress well. So there's some other things that you've done in this true transformation that's also going on at the same time. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So just... So once you start there, then you say, okay, so regeneration is creating the conditions for the system to flourish, for life to flourish, actually. And how do you then transform? What does that mean for a company? How do you transform for that? So we've been working with some really wonderful, very ambitious companies. For example, the Spanish Acciona, which is an infrastructure company. They do everything from build water sanitation plants to the Sao Paulo metro, you know, really big things, energy systems and so on. And they've really, they have taken this on board and said, okay, so how do we do this? And all their former sustainability targets, you know, they've gone, okay, so what does this look like with a regenerative lens as well as a responsibility and a resilience lens? What does it mean for diversity and inclusion? Because if we say that the gender balance is 50-50 on the management, that's responsible. But what does that mean? How do you do that regeneratively? What's the difference here? So we've really helped them dig into some of those things, which are super interesting, because the regenerative angle, of course, is how do you continue to feed so that never stops being an equal gender balance, for example. But more interestingly, and that's I think what you and I spoke about previously was, they are looking at their projects. So saying, okay, instead of taking an order or being part of a tender that says, let's build this bridge. And those tenders from a local authority tend to be the speed, the quality, the price. And you know, more and more, maybe a little bit about the carbon emissions, but not many other criteria are set up. So what does it look like if you want to have that as a regenerative project? Well, that means you look at the context of that local area, and you're saying, well, what does the population need? What's the demographic? What does the biodiversity needs? What's the financial needs and jobs for those people? And what is that going to be in 10 years? So we had a fun one that was a bridge, which was, you know, if you put a bridge in this town in Spain, then that's all fine. But Spain is going to probably be 10 degrees hotter in 10 years. So if you put more traffic, cars, and even if you have EVs, actually most of the pollution comes from the tires, not the not just the tailpipe. If you have that combined with heat and 10 degrees hotter, you're creating a real health risk for that population. So obviously you have to look at that system in a completely different way than responding to a tender. And that's what a company like Acciona, that's what I get excited about, because then they're taking that responsibility, comes back to the entrepreneur, right? They're taking the responsibility and saying, let's have the bigger conversation with three of the silos in the local authority, the health, as well as the planning department. And let's take that long-term view and that broader umbrella. Anyway, those kind of projects we're doing for some really interesting companies around the world, which is great fun.
I don't know if you've run into this, but I run into it all the time. It's very difficult when you have a company like that who's now coming up with a great solution for the bridge of the future, or what does that crossing the river or a waterway look like for the future, that now they've come up with a very regenerative, very resilient solution, but they're involving three or four ministries: the Ministry of Energy, the Ministry of Transportation, the Ministry, you know, and so in that process, they go to the Ministry of Transportation. We've got this great thing. We're thinking about the future, but we also need to involve the Ministry of Health or the Ministry of Air Quality or Environment there. And they're like, oh, no, that's transportation. Stay with transportation. None of those infrastructures, and this is what we talked about earlier, is none of those ministries are on the same page. They're not communicating with each other. They're not sharing monies. They're not sharing that vision for the future. And they don't have a unified operating system to communicate. So this is where the stifle comes in with these organizations. They have this beautiful thing. It's very regenerative, very resilient, future thinking. And they get caught up in this bureaucratic trap almost to move forward. What are you seeing policy-wise? What are you seeing to help with organizations? Is that, when we talked about it as well earlier, and I wanted to kind of mention that, is that where, even though we're creating these regional local projects or businesses that are coming up with these things, is that where they can then go to a big organization like Ellen MacArthur Foundation, or to Cradle to Cradle, or to the B Corp or something, and say, hey, I want to do this. I'm dealing with it locally, but now look, I've got this big infrastructure, big system. Can you help?
Yeah.
What are you seeing?
So I'm not seeing that, because I don't think at this point, I am seeing what you, as in, I'm not seeing what they're going to those organizations. What I'm seeing, which is really interesting, is that actually this is where finance comes in, finance and policy in my mind. What I'm seeing is that funding this and wrapping it becomes essential. So one of the things we've actually done as a spin-off of this project with Acciona is create not just a playbook for the Acciona new business guys of how to have different conversations about regeneration, but a kind of toolkit or workshop sort of for development banks, because a lot of this stuff is actually within the remit of development banks. So to help them understand how do they navigate these local things? How do they make sure that they could fund truly regenerative systems projects in a different way? I think that's one of the keys. The other piece, and I'm going to jump to a Scottish project we've been working on actually in the Leavenmouth. So Leavenmouth is a place in Scotland which is terribly deprived in all ways, with jobs, education, the environment, and so on. and the Scottish Environmental Protection Agency, which we've been working with for 4 years now, I think maybe five, they took a lead and said, we're going to create, not just look at the environment, but we're going to create a partnership that with private companies like Diageo, who's got a big plant up there, with the Scottish Railways, with the local council, and create this as a whole system where we regenerate everything at the same time, which has been in itself super exciting. And to see some of those projects are coming out now. But the thing that gets me even more excited than that is, well, can you get investors to look at this as a different asset class? So instead of saying, yeah, we want to fund the riverbanks being better or whatever, saying, well, actually, we're going to fund this as a whole system, because we can see that having 12 projects rather than one is going to have a synergistic effect and give us more back on our investment money than if we were just funding one little thing. And that's one of the financial pieces, which I think is not underestimated, but sort of. I could make a connection here, because the Tomorrow's Capitalism inquiry I talked about, which led us to the 3 R's, one of the other big conclusions from that was that even companies who wanted to, and we're back in 2019, that even big companies who wanted to transform, had a plan to transform to something different, to being more regenerative, they didn't know how to explain this to the finance and to banks at all. And my caveat is, last couple of years, the finance sector has shifted quite substantially. But what we were able to do was to create an initiative called Bankers for Net Zero, which we launched in 2019, with the UK Parliament, one of the parliamentary groups for fair business banking. And we brought together industry and banks to try and figure out how might the regulations, and we did this for the UK specifically to start with, how might regulation policy shift the amount of money flowing from banks to, in net zero businesses or those types of projects. And that was a really interesting piece, because you need the three pods of that chair. You need industry, you need the banks and the finance, and you need policy and regulation to back up around this. And that's been really successful. We just spun it out earlier this year into its own company, the Bankers for Net Zero, which is now part of, sort of under the umbrella of the UN Global Banking Alliance for Net Zero. But those, again, it comes back to collaboration in a really different way than what we've seen before. There's always been collaboration, of course, but kind of always with a knife in your back pocket, as far as I'm concerned. Pretty competitive. And yet
it's a very competitive collaboration.
Yeah. And now it seems that businesses are on such a knife edge of a situation, and businesses are under such threat from this uncertainty that it's riskier not to collaborate openly with the whole industry and with your competitors and beyond, far beyond your industry, than it is to try and hold it on. At least sensible businesses will be doing that. And we're seeing more and more of it. We're just, again, launching another project around, which will be peer supported, really. How can companies be better advocates in policy for big systemic changes? A little bit. I always joke about it and say, we're trying to figure out how the fossil fuel industry, the tobacco industry, and the sugar industry in America in particular, what did they do to have such a stranglehold for so many decades? And why and how can we use that for good? So that's another little project. But again, it will be, it's a lot of it, the knowledge is in those corporations, and we can unlock that and have them support each other as peers in a safe environment. So we do some of that as well, which is exciting, because the scale of transformation we need is so enormous. And you mentioned, I have to go back to, you mentioned Yvonne from Patagonia, who's just announced that he's given the company to a trust to fight climate change, which is extraordinary. And yet, you know, it seemed impossible thing for anybody to do. And yet I could see why he, as somebody who's been leading on this for so many years, would think, well, this is inevitable. We have to, I think, and I think we will all be called in the next 5 years, if not earlier, to do something we would never have imagined in the, you know, 5 years ago or today. That the changes needed is so incredible. And giving away your company to fight climate change, you know, you, and if you've heard the podcast or the video interview our website. So, because one of the things we found actually after we did all this work was people don't know what regeneration is. So we did, so we've done a series of interviews and articles just to help beef up that movement. And it's the same reason why we were lucky enough to, I've known Daniel Christianval for a few years and I love his work. And so it's the fellowship is not an acknowledgement of what he has done, which has been great. It's in order to enable him to work more on this and to think and to help companies really flourish with this regenerative thinking. Because yeah, we've got to do a lot of it.
Oh, absolutely. He's not only did he get your fellowship, he got another award this year.
Oh yeah,
year,
the RSA.
RSA.
He got a very special award from the RSA, the Bicentenary Medal, which is amazing. And so we do some work with the RSA and that it's wonderful. Our award is more financial because I really wanted it to be something that would take the pressure off him. He's a, you know, a brilliant thinker, but he doesn't have a company behind him to support him. He gets asked to do a lot of things for free. And I wanted him to be able to write his next book actually and continue to do that thinking.
I agree. I'm so glad you guys did that. I think it's fabulous. That's what I mean. The type of work you do, the transformations, the people that you have are just it's bottom up. It's organizations who really have the power to change at all different levels. And so I'm really glad we could speak again, even though I've talked to John. I think you bring a whole beautiful breadth into what you do on the day-to-day and other activities for Volans. There's a lot more transformations going on in your organization than I think that we know about, besides the ones I've already mentioned. And I think it's pretty bold to say we're not doing projects or not doing different changes. We're actually working on transformations. Can you tell us more why you've chosen that, why transformations are so important, and what's the direction behind that?
Oh, that's a big question. I guess it's partly necessity. We did quite a lot of work just when I was joined Volans on sort of exponential change and how innovations could drive exponential rather than incremental step-by-step change. And it just became apparent that we don't have time for incremental change. We have time, we should all be doing incremental change, but where we felt we could contribute most, so that's my dog snoring.
That's fine.
Where we could contribute most as an organization and as individuals was to really push ambitious change into the world and help people do that. And it might be worth just talking, you talked about our organization. So we're small, we're not 20 people. And the way I set it up, I guess, was as a constellation where we have people like Daniel as a fellow. We have some amazing associates who are wonderful people in their own right and do their own projects, but then come in and help us at certain times for specific projects. But we work incredibly hard to find the good, right people who have a resilience and a playfulness that they can deal with this despair that we could be surrounded by, really, because the outlook is really bleak, and yet have the optimism and the strength to act. I think that is a quality that we have to have in this time. It's the most important thing. It's not problem solving. It's not being creative. It's actually just being able to hold that and still move forward. This you know, potential despair. And so we work quite hard at that with the team in the best possible way, to allow them to grow and to learn. And obviously it's a privilege to work with John, but equally it's a privilege to work with all of the team, because they're all from, you know, we have 20-year-old students who are just brilliant. And so to be able to forge that, I think, is really important. And maybe I can, you know, the next, I think for me, how I lead that and how everybody leads wherever they are in the team is really important. And what I would like to see next is really a shift in how we train, educate, and how we allow people to learn and unlearn some of the things that there is. And this is what we're seeing in the transformations in business, by the way. We are seeing that the insights and the wisdom is there. It's not like we, you know, we are not standard consultants who come in and go, right, let's explain to you how you're going to transform at all, which is sometimes quite troublesome because people would love the answers. Instead, we try and ask and the really important questions, and the questions that allow people to dig into their wisdom. The wisdom they've had from working in the organization, but also from life. And if we can do that at a broader scale, so instead of focusing so much on certain skills and actually removing from young people the ability to tap into that wisdom, because they're so focused on the grades and the next bits they have to learn off by heart. If we can acknowledge that this is uncertain and nobody knows what it's going to be useful to know, we know that Google's quite good at it, but digging, you know, holding that uncertainty and being able to really lead with uncertainty, lead your own life and still tap into a strength. That's where, that's the next transformation I would like to see happen in the educational space. You mentioned, you know, I work with several business schools, as does other people in the team, but really going further down than the business schools into younger people who need it most right now.
I absolutely love that. And I mean, with transformations, a lot of people really haven't been made aware of this or don't understand it. We find ourselves in the Anthropocene, deep in the Anthropocene, and we really need to kind of progress into a new epoch that has positive narratives and positive futures for humanity. I'm calling that the Symbiocene. And others have as well, through the book Earth Emotions, and other people talk about symbiosis and symbiocene and regeneration economic or regenerative economic models and things like that. But before we even had the Millennium Development Goals, humanity has always needed to make six major transformations. The one in business, and I don't know about you, that I've heard about the most is always the digital revolution, the digital transformation. You know, are we prepared for that new pioneering technology, you know, blockchain and big data and all the other buzzwords, but it's really the digital transformation. Well, that's the sixth transformation that's needed to make to get us to that new epoch. The other one is, you know, transformation of sustainable cities and communities, transformation of food and water and land. You know, there's the transformation of education, health and well-being, you know, just those simple transformations that there are six of them. But those are all required to reach the Sustainable Development Goals. The Sustainable Development Goals paved the way for ESG, so did the triple bottom line and the whole taxonomy from the EU. Those six transformations, whether you believe in the goals, whether you don't believe in those, they still are required. And so when you use the word transformations, and in Volans, you also call regenerators as kind of another form of transformers or transformational people trying to get us on the right side of history. There's a lot of work to do. And besides projects, besides that change, I see transformation as something that takes us into a new epoch. Once you've opened that door, you can never go back to the Anthropocene. You're in that new epoch. You know, it's like that imaginal cells from Kim Pullman and Paul Pullman, and that beautiful book, that you go from that caterpillar into the chrysalis and emerge as a butterfly. And butterfly, you can't go back to that chrysalis. You know,
absolutely. Absolutely. And no, I think that's really interesting and very true. The danger I see, if I can be frank.
Sure, please.
Is that we are so set in our mindset that most people, when they hear, I think, that those six transformations, which are exactly right, you know, we need to transform education and cities and so on, and the digital transformation, they still see it as a mechanical transformation, in a sense that, oh, okay, so we move X, Y, and Z, and then this happens, where they don't see that it's actually a qualitative shift, that transformation as well. And that's where communicating in different ways becomes really important. It's similar when lots of people are talking about systems change. Lots of very good people are then, you know, drawing big mind maps and saying, okay, so the intervention points are here, here, here. And when you look at it, you say, well, that would work if this was a machine. But actually, we have to acknowledge that we are part of a dynamic living system, and we cannot predict what's going to happen when you touch that intervention point. And we have to, and again, it's that thing, we have to see it both as the system, but also as the individual. So I would argue that the big transformation, without sounding too soft about it, but I do think it comes from the transformation of our, I guess, our confidence, let's call it that, that we start trusting what we are as humans, that we are part of something bigger, and that we have to forge that path kind of on our own, despite the fact the system is telling us, for example, that we should just focus on profit and that's the only way to be successful is X, Y, Z. I had a really interesting experience the other day where I met some young people and I chatted with them, and it was great. They were fantastic. And then afterwards they said, you can't quite believe that you're a CEO. And I said, well, what is a CEO meant to be like then? You know? And so I don't even think it was gender. It was just that it's so strong. And we've had decades of a certain image, not just of CEOs, but of what is needed and what success looks like. And we have to shift that quite significantly. And I hope we can do it without going into an apocalyptic situation for humanity.
I really hope so.
No, yeah. But that is my deep hope. But somehow we have to flip that switch where we can start thinking differently and transforming ourselves, so that when we look at the transformation for cities, when we look at the digital transformation, when we look at the educational system, we are doing it from a different place than where we are now, inside. And I think Paul Polman would agree. So one of the things you didn't mention, and I probably didn't mention it to you, is we have this book club calling it the Green Swans Book Club. And Paul Polman came on a few months back when he had just come out with his new book. And we talked about love angels, that humans are actually love angels, was his the thing that's not in that book, which I love so much. We talked about faith and how important, whatever faith you have, how important some kind of belief system is to this transformation, actually. Yeah, it's a great book.
Yeah, Net Positive is a great book, but I'm glad that he talked about that. I mean, you have to also say that it was in conjunction with Andrew Winston on that book. So
yes,
there's a lot of wise
wisdom. Andrew's amazing. Obviously, Andrew has poured all his expertise into it. He's a good friend. Really, I admire him so much. It was only because you mentioned Paul, and it was that quote about faith that was really interesting. So I think that's there. So I think transformation is important. I know that some of the business leaders that I've worked with have said, well, I've tried to figure this out. And then people tell me I have to go and sit in a forest and meditate before I can transform my business. How can that be? And I say, well, you don't have to, because I think that's our job. That's our job as Volans. That's your job as part of the sustainability regenerative movement. the UN is to allow people to come in through the doorway they can come in through as fast as possible without watering down the principles, without letting them get away with greenwashing, et cetera, et cetera. But we have to push people and to the door that is most comfortable for them. And then they can go on the journey and start transforming both themselves and their organization. So we do a lot of that, I think, is when you talk about what Volans does, is it's about catalyzing, but it's also about bridging from this old system that we are standing in. And every leader now has been successful in the old system. And now we're telling them to shift. That's pretty hard, right?
That's really hard.
Because we don't know. And some of the, you know, we've been doing some work with the Selfridges group, you know, luxury department stores all over the world. And the CEO of that group, one of the things I admire most about her, and there are several things I admire, Ann Pitcher, she's born and bred retail since she was 16. She's been on a shop floor, but she knows what she doesn't know necessarily. And she has the courage to bring other people in, to listen to them and to take leaps in that uncertainty. And so for me, that is, it's the courage in uncertainty that is incredibly important for leaders as we go forward.
I think that's part of this transformation as well. We need to meet everyone where they're at and mm-hmm. understand where they're at to help them on the journey the rest of the way that maybe is very alien to them of where they're going and where they should go. Now, with responsibility, resilience, and regeneration, I think it's set a beautiful standard moving forward. In resilience, and that's really going to be the next iteration after the Sustainable Development Goals, it'll be the Resilience Development Goals. We already began working on them in 2019.
Yes.
There's a huge mistake or a huge misunderstanding of the definition of resilience. And you mentioned one of the definitions in the beginning is kind of how a lot of people see that. You know, there's the resilience of emotion and mentally, if somebody swears or hits you or spits on you, that you have this emotional, mental, physical resilience to bounce back. Then there's the very dystopian resilience where humanity, you and I are still surviving, but we're wearing a gas mask or a spacesuit or an oxygen mask to enjoy what little beauty there could be or just to survive. It's kind of a dystopian resilience and it's very competitive. And it's also, you know, kind of what we see in a lot of the media today. Or there's this other form of resilience that has a lot to do with what we talked about as well in the beginning of this. We're building that infrastructure, we're preparing that path to have, no matter what the climate catastrophe, no matter what the conflict and the things that come down the road, the policy, the infrastructure, the way has been paved that we can bounce back the very next day, the very next hour with resilience to have clean water and sanitation, to have clean air, to have food, to have business. And so when I hear resilience, that is really important for me. Now, having said that, what I've experienced, I want to see if you've experienced as well. Before the pandemic, before the economic downturn, before the Brexit, before the Ukraine war, before all this craziness we've just been through, sometimes I felt like I was talking till I was blue in the face with organizations and companies that are like, oh, that's expensive. That's hard to do. I'm used to this old model. And are you sure? And it just was never there. Mm. And I hate to say any of these things were a blessing, but boy, people are knocking down our doors. I would imagine for you as well, saying, we wish we'd have listened. We would have had that resilience. We would have had a little bit more stability. We would have had a better plan. Can you help us get back to there? Are you also seeing that? And how do you feel about that?
Mm. Thank you. Yeah, no, that's a great question. I think you're right. I think it's, we have to be careful with language and as you say, resilience can be seen in several ways. And what that brings up for me is actually this is when I say we our approach is about being creative and human and unlocking. That's exactly it. Because if we can just start from the accepting that uncertainty is going to happen, that means that your transformation, unlike as an organization, unlike a digital transformation from here to here, is about transforming the capacity to deal with whatever comes next, knowing that you're not going to have a clue what comes next, but you can set up the systems, whether you're talking the global systems, infrastructure, water, et cetera, or whether you're talking organizational systems of supporting each other, diversity, so you know you've got all points of view, all those kinds of things, is really important. So I think that's an extremely important point. And I sometimes get sort of quite animated, let's say, about people when people say, oh, you guys are consultants. And I'm like, yeah, but the consultancy model of age is broken because it does not build capacity within organizations. It doesn't build resilience because it's built on the consultancy model. The sort of general consultancy model is exactly the opposite. It's give people something so that they need you to come back. Not to build and you know, generously build capacity in the people you are working with. So that's the one piece. So the question you really asked, which I shall answer as well, is, are we seeing that? Yes, we are seeing every organization of weird kinds that we some of many of them that we would not work with, because again we have to pick very carefully because we are small. Wanting to understand how can they do better. And that's, you know, that's fantastic. Is it great it happened because of the situation we're in now? No, I think if it hadn't been a pandemic and an economic downturn, it would have been something else, potentially, you know, something much worse, because we have been heading into this U-bend for a while. And our job now, as we are, I think, hopefully about to go into the last worst bit, is setting ourselves up for how to come out. If we pick the right work we do now, then likelihood is we can come out as a better world, versus the opposite. But it is heartening to see that everybody is, that so many organizations and yet I'm going to hold it. It's still not everybody. I still have people, if I'm at social events, nothing to do with work, who say, oh, sustainability. Oh yeah. Yeah. That's becoming quite popular now. So, you know, are you making lots of money off it? And I think, wow.
What?
but that they see it as a new business opportunity rather than that personal. But the people who allow themselves to be, I guess, whole humans, and this is why the school strikes were so important, they are experiencing the issues in the world and hearing from their children, where are you on this, Dad? And more normally it is Dad, I have to say, you know, or Mum, but normally it's, you know, what are you doing? So what action are you taking with the power you have? You know, I sometimes fall into that trap. Last year when COP26 was in Glasgow, I really wasn't sure I wanted to go because it sometimes feels like quite a big circus. I know you were there as well.
It was a big circus.
And it's a big circus. And I sort of said, well, you know, do I want to have the, you know, go and participate in this? Is it really going to make the difference? And then I have three children. From you know, at that time they were 14 to 21, and I was chatting with them, and they were talking about how they were going to go on the, you know, one of them was going to go to Glasgow for the strikes or the marches, one of them was going to do it in Cambridge, da, 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 all different places, and they were talking about how they feel they have nowhere other way of making a difference. They, you know, they're vegan and buy hardly anything new and all those things you can do, but they don't have a voice. And it dawned on me that who am I to say, no, I don't want to be part of the circus. If I have a voice, and I was invited to all these things, and actually there were so many conversations at COP with people who had never thought about these issues before in a real way and who had decided to come to learn. And a few of them, you know, they were sort of said, you would have had the same, oh, have I just been asleep at the wheel for the 40 years of my career when I thought I was being successful? And so, you know, I went because I feel we all have to really step up and make our voices heard. And it's a beautiful circle back to the beginning where we talked about communications. We have to figure out how to have those conversations with everyone, whether it's, you know, on the bus, if you're in a country that where people speak on the bus, no, don't do that in England, but or at work or with your hairdresser or whatever. And we have to signal that things are transforming. And if we still allow ourselves to have, obviously, you know, don't have to have every very serious conversation, but if we don't use what we know and our voices, even in questioning the status quo on a day-to-day level, then it doesn't matter if we work in sustainability. You know, we can't not be activists now. I think that's the biggest thing. And the joy is that there are so many people in the corporate world who are beginning to take that on personally and in their work lives, where they have an awful lot of power to shift things.
I totally agree. And I mean, for me, it's like a habit. It's just, it's ingrained. It's a daily activity and it just never ends. It's also, I can't turn the light off anymore. I can't crawl back in that chrysalis. It just is there. Once you see the world in that way, once you understand the bigger pictures and you understand that, in some respects, it is right. There is an opportunity there. So I hate to when people say, oh, that's a sustainability, it's a big business opportunity, some kind of a profit-making thing. No, it's just a better business model. When you help a million people who are suffering with their global grand challenges, you're not a millionaire in a monetary sense, but you're a millionaire in a much deeper sense of seeing the world. If you help a billion people with their problems, you're a billionaire, but not in a monetary sense, in a much deeper way that really comes back multiple fold. And it is a better business model. It's a better model for life. It's the model that works. That's what symbiosis is. It's the way the world has always worked, in collaboration and cooperation, not in competition, not in this, only the strongest survive, natural selection, severe competition. That's not how the world works. We somehow thought it was, but it just isn't. That's not how it's ever worked. Yeah.
We bought into economic man, you know, all the way, didn't we?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not the reports, it's not the graphs, it's not the books that really help. It's the good stories and just in your own personal life on a local way, or in an organization on a small, very local one-to-one story. That's how that transformation happens. It's not this big, huge global monster that's overwhelming. It's kind of small transformations that happen on individual basis. You know, before this time, I would always talk about the Stern Report or the Stern Review and how, you know, it's just absolutely proven that it's a better model. Let's apply it and the outcomes will be much better than business as usual, than doing it in this old way. Because a lot of organizations say, boy, it's expensive to be sustainable. It's expensive to be regenerative. And it's not.
I think that's, and you're hitting on exactly why it's now. It's they're realizing it's expensive not to be prepared for this.
It's huge risk. Supply chain, risk. Food, everything.
Across the board, it is a big risk. And if we can start, it's fine to start acting differently because you're seeing a risk, because eventually you'll realize that actually it is a huge opportunity in so many ways, including for the economic man and the profit line.
So you guys have really started in not only with your Green Swads book club, the podcast and kind of discussions, you've talked to many different people, but you guys have also started to get involved in some education and trainings kind of to prepare people, not only organizations and different levels. And there was this course with the Capital Institute and John Fullerton. You also participated. John participated, and many others that I'm jealous I wasn't asked to participate. Oh. Jeremy Lent, you were, Hunter Lovins, Alan Savory. Laura Storm. I mean,
There's a second cohort starting.
My name, please. I'm so jealous. I wasn't, but it was, wonderful. You guys talked about regenerative economics, systems thinking, the 8 principles of regenerative vitality. Mm-hmm. One, I want to know how it went, but I also want to know what your feelings are on these new economic models that are emerging. We're seeing the Club of Rome. We're seeing all these new economic models and saying, hey, these old systems, this old way of looking at capitalism or economics, extractive, neoclassical or classical economics, it's just not working for us anymore. We need some new ways of looking at it. And you're actually not just talking about those, you're joining forces with these people to create these courses and participate to have those discussions. So one, I want to know more about that and kind of why is that? Why are we seeing that? Give us the insider.
So first I would say that I feel our part, whilst we are a strategic partner of the Capital Institute for the regenerative economics course, we're a very small cog and part of that. And John Fullerton and the team, Tomas, Ernesto, Alexandra, are brilliant and have pulled it together, I think, in a brilliant way. So it went very well. I think the first cohort had 250 or 300 people, so online. And those people are still, and I put our whole team on it as participants. So we did some of the podcast or the learning sessions modules, but everybody got an opportunity from the team to take part, and it was heavy. It was a lot of content. There's so much fantastic stuff that you you almost want to go on holiday and have it and go through the course, but what's interesting is it was obvious that there was such a hunger to build a community around it. So people are still in conversation on the course platform now, 4 months later. I'm still getting, oh, Louise, I saw this. I thought you might find this interesting. People want to collaborate. And again, it's one of the great hopes and sort of sources of optimism, is that people want to make a difference and people want to learn. So that was that's one economics course. Obviously, before that, and we've had Kate with Donut Economics, Mariana Mazzucato and the mission-based economy, who's one of my favorite people to interview actually on the book club. So Mariana came on. She is a wonderful, wonderful woman. And I think,
just for those on the podcast or who are listening, Mariana Mazzucato from Mission Economics, and she's written several wonderful books, but she's really great. Kate Roworth, Donut Economics, so as well. So you've had the best of the best out there.
Yeah, really, they are both trained economists who've kind of gone rogues to some extent and come up with these models that work for the planetary boundaries and for the future. I am so thrilled to see that they are gaining traction. It is still very small, but I think there is a lot of hope for it to grow exponentially, primarily through the EU, and this is where policy again comes in. Because several EU policymakers have really paid attention to both of those sort of strands of economics. Is it enough? No, but it is growing because it's so obvious. We have let the world slip in the standard economics to a point where it's really clear it's not working. You have to, the fact that there is 1 million people in poverty in the UK, it's becoming so obvious, and that's where the joy of having the younger, the millennials, but then Gen Z and alphas coming up behind them, they just won't accept this world like this. And I think that's when we'll see those economics go further. John Fullerton's course, again, Capital Institute course is fantastic. And John has all this experience as a banker for decades, so he knows the ins and outs of that, and he's really worked hard to learn and apply that to these principles of what could a regenerative economic system look like. And there's lots to learn. I would highly recommend it as a course to anyone, but there's a lot of content is what I would say. I've still got a couple I haven't watched yet. But there are also other pieces in it, and some people might be overwhelmed by the economics part of that. There are lots, we're seeing this, and it's interesting. As I said, I work with several business schools. I'm on the board of Exeter Business School, which has always been focused on sustainability and innovation and is doubling down on that. But there's a lot of competition from other types of learning. So you have Laura Storm's Regenerative
Leadership. Yeah. I've got that
whole
book
year,
here too.
Which is a great course. Again, it's more personal. And you've got a few other courses. We can put the links up with
Jeremy. Podcast. Yeah, I can put it up as well. Jeremy Lentz in there.
The Web of Meaning.
That's a great regenerative course. Leadership. I mean, it's just one after the other. Yeah. Superstars. I'm a student of Herman Daly. So basically, I studied ecological economics and steady state economics with Herman at the University of Maryland, and have.
How lucky!
I'm very lucky. So I'm a big fan of that. And I think that's the direction we're going. Most people don't even know, and I've talked about it before, that there are more than 21 different types of ecological economic models out there. You know, the ones you just spoke about, mission economics, donut economics, there's now the emergence of planetary boundary type of economic models, regenerative economics, shared economics, platform economics, on and on. I could, more than 21, there's probably more popping up all the time. And so we really, one, the reason they're popping up is because we're sick of neoclassical macro economics that just aren't working for us anymore. We wait till the next bubble emerges and it pops or it doesn't pop and we get a bailout. And we go right back to that same system that never worked for us in the beginning.
Yes.
What's new? What is working? And then there's a little added confusion because do we do circular economy? Do we do donut economics? Do we do regenerative economics, or is it all of those in the same thing? And how does that look like? How does it work? So it's really good that we understand it. We kind of get into that. And that's hard because, like you said, it can be, you might need a vacation from the course, or you might need to go on vacation to absorb the course. But most people don't realize that how much our lives are impacted from economic models wherever we live in the world, whatever. Exactly. We feel like we don't have anything to do with it. That's wrong. We have so much to do with that and to shape it. That's why it's important to kind of understand that, because even if you don't adhere to certain models or to the way certain governments or organizations or things are working, you can create your own internal family economy, your own regenerative self-organization that
absolutely
doesn't break any laws, but it creates this new thing. Yeah.
No, exactly. So first of all, I am really jealous. So I did the classic, I did PPE at Oxford. So that's micro, straight down the line of economics.
Snooze.
I guess one of the things that again makes me hopeful is you've got people within the finance industry looking at some of this. So you've got people like the wonderful Steve Waygood of Aviva Investors, who is basically looking at what are the tools that are being used every day that is a reflection of that economic system. And if we can change those little pieces of tools that the analysts are using to value a company to something better, then we're dismantling the existing economic system. And so I think that's where, at least that's where I think, oh, I can see the hope in that. Because as you say, the economic systems of, I love that, I think it's Amsterdam who's taken donut economics and said, right, we're going to apply this. Brilliant. My home city of Copenhagen is looking at the same thing. Fantastic. But as a human being, that's really hard to deal with. What can we do? It just feels so big. And should, is it donut or should you do something else? Where's the ecological side of that? Is planetary boundaries included in donut economics or not? Yes, lots of debates going on. But if people in the finance industry can go, okay, so this tool, actually, I know that this tool, discounts the future when I'm looking at the value of a company, then, and if we can shift those things, those small things, and I think there's a resurgence, weirdly, in those small, quite boring things that we don't notice, that similar to contracts law, how contracts are put together make a huge difference to the world and how we behave to each other. So those kinds of things are really interesting. And I think lawyers and accountants and sort of bankers, who are not the people I would normally put lots of faith in because they work on the plumbing, they have a huge role to play now to spot the opportunity for shifts and then start agitating for some of those shifts somehow. So I think that's really interesting. B Corps, of course, is one sort of way of taking that governance piece, but there are others, and yeah, everybody has a role to play.
I don't know if we've covered it or if you mentioned it. You guys have a strong push now, or corporate advocacy projects or transformations that you're doing. Can you tell us a little bit more about that, exactly what that means?
I don't know if we covered it already, but it really is for companies to explore how can they best have an influence in the world. We all know that companies have an influence in how they produce and sell things, of course, how they advertise, but also most companies are involved in trade associations and in direct conversations with government on policy, either national government or local government, or pan-European, for example, with the EU. And most of the people who are working within that space feel quite alone, and they don't really know what other people are doing. And so what we're doing is bringing together a group of companies that have ambitions to have a bigger purpose and impact in the world than themselves, and allowing them to learn from each other, looking at other frameworks that could be created from those experiences and from what our research has shown of what is effective. So that each of those companies at least are more effective, and we can spread something to a bigger group of companies. So it should be quite exciting. It kicks off in the autumn.
I have four more questions for you until we're done, and this next one is actually be the hardest one that I've asked you so far. But I prepared you long time ago, whether you remember or not. What does a world that works for everyone look like to you, Louise? What does a world that works for everyone look like for you?
So this, I am gathering references to Bucky Fuller.
Very spot on.
And I don't remember you preparing me for this. I think it's quite simple because it links directly to what I consider my personal purpose in life, which is about allowing and creating the conditions for each human being. I want to extend it beyond human beings, potentially into the animal kingdom too, the natural world, but for each person to flourish and be at their very, very best as a human. That really is it. I could describe it with this is what a city would look like, and this is, but that is what it is. I believe that will require or will lead to abundance of everything. Right now we have lived for many, many years in a sense of and a society that accepts scarcity, which is where I think the competitiveness and economic man comes from. We've convinced ourselves that everything is scarce, when really everything in life is abundant. And if we can tap into that and allow every person to be at their very, very, very best, that doesn't mean you can do everything and that we can all fly or whatever, but that, then I think Bucky Fuller would have liked that too.
I love it. That's great. Now, I already in this kind of showed you my favorite book of all time. This, I love Green Swans, but I have to tell you, this is my favorite book ever. I've read it dozens of times. Jeremy wrote a section in my book. He's a fabulous man, but I've been looking for years, and I've even asked John this question when he was on there. Is there one place out there, a university, a book, a place to gain this systemic, this complexity knowledge of the world and how to make sense of it, how to move forward? What tools can we do? Some sense of empowerment or understanding of this world, of all the things that I'm pretty sure you studied as well. I've studied, you know, I'm a graduate of Capra courses from Fritz Hof Capra. I'm big fan of Bucky. And the list goes on and on, who are all environmentalists, great business leaders, great people around that. But I never found a book that really brought it all together and made sense of it and then left you with a good. And that's this. So the question is not really telling you my favorite book, but I want to know, what's your favorite book that you've ever read? You've interviewed a lot of people, you've taught. I'd like to really know what your thoughts and feelings are. What's the best book you've ever read?
Oh my goodness, that's hard. So first of all, look, I've got it here on my table because I'm rereading it at the moment. The best book ever.
It's hard, isn't it?
It's the hardest question. I think this is much harder than the view of the world.
Before this one, mine, I don't know if you've ever read Richard Bach Illusions, but before Jeremy's book, that was probably, I would have to say, that was one of my favorite Richard Bach Illusions.
Illusions was one of my absolute favorite books. I gave it to everyone.
Me too. Gave it to everyone. Yeah. Fabulous. And then the other one, you kind of mentioned this as well, because in your answer of what does a world that works for everyone look like, you said your purpose for existing or your why. And one of my good friends, the very first podcast I ever did was John P. Strelecki, The Big Five for Life, The Purpose for Existing. It was today a museum day. Fabulous book. Fabulous. Oh my goodness. Great read. Easy. I always call it the toilet read, but so deep. But yeah, anyway, I don't want to, yeah. I'm trying to give you time to think.
I know. You are. Maybe I can actually, I've got a copy of it here. This is a copy to give away. This is not the best book I've ever read, but it's one of the best books I've recently read. And I think it's really important. It's by Julia Bell and it's called Radical Attention. And it's about the battle for attention in this age of distraction. It draws on so many other books to be incredibly concise and easy to read. In fact, one of my daughters stole it from me and read it within sort of 10 hours when we were traveling to and from the Netherlands on a train. Really, really easy. And it shows that, because it has both that systemic piece and it's got the personal piece, which I love. So it's attention and what we pay attention to and how we spend our time matters. So it's less systemic than all those books that you mentioned, which again, I love. And it's funny, Illusions really was my favorite book for many years. Also the Daniel Quinn book, what's it called?
Yes, I love Daniel Quinn's book. Yeah.
So a couple of Daniel Quinn book I love. And sometimes, and I think this is an interesting point potentially, sometimes those novels, and fiction books can give us a lot. Another one I would mention, which is not to hand right now, which I would wave at you, is I do think also the Ministry for the Future.
I've got that right here too.
Fan's book was but
in
not
Stanley Robinson.
Yes. And one of the things I did at COP was co-organize an event with Club of Rome for Nigel Topping, and he came as part of that. So I'm a big fan of that book. Not easy read though. I think Julia Bell would get my vote for the moment. But
yeah, that's not an easy read. He's a nice person, but it is a good book. I've got
it's a great book. But this one I would highly recommend, Julia Bell, The Radical Attention. Short, but very, very punchy. And I'd argue everybody would get quite affected by it. Trying to think what else. I also had the pleasure of meeting and spending time with Sister True Dedication from Plum Village, the Buddhist monastery and several of the monastics there in France this year. And she co-wrote a book with her now passed away teacher Thay, or Thich Nhat Hanh, and called Zen and the Art of Saving the Planet, which I also think is a book worth reading for most people. But yeah, I'm not a one horse person, as you can tell.
I'm not either. I do like 3 to 4 books a week that I read, and I've started to go into academic books now because I'm running out of other books. But I have an addiction that's really bad. I feel ashamed sometimes.
No, I think it's, but I think this idea, and again, comes back to learning and education, that it has to be continuous. And by continuing to read, we nurture our humility that we don't know everything. And sometimes we read books that just enforce that we know stuff, which is also wonderful. But to nurture curiosity and to nurture that idea that things are moving, I think it's just so important.
Yeah, and I listen to all the book club podcasts or the videos that you guys do on the book club, and I love it. I thank you guys for that work, I'm so glad that you and John both have taken the time to really speak to me and spend time. Not only did I learn that, but my audience really appreciates John, appreciates what you guys do for the world, and we need to let them know about what tools, who's out there, who's supporting, who's kind of carrying that banner, who's there to help. Because I don't want to downgrade you, but you guys are humane. You're people, and reality, and you love to see us all get on the right side of history. The last two questions are really: if there was one message that you could depart to my listeners, maybe even two messages as a sustainable takeaway that has the power to change their life, what would those messages be?
That's a good one. I think it would be, and I know this is contrary to one of the podcasts I heard because you said the opposite, but I think we all have to be activists now. And we have to be stubborn activist optimists is where I would put it. That is the most important thing, to really continue to work. And it's fine to take time off, and you shouldn't feel guilty for relaxing or watching TV, but we cannot afford the slumber anymore. We cannot afford to kind of drug ourselves with nonsensical television, sugar, alcohol, drugs, shopping, and not see and not act. I think that it's hugely important that we all just take just a little step in that direction if we're not already acting.
I love how you phrase that, because I do believe that some of those things that you listed there make us numb. They desensitize us. They keep us from even being able to see what's going on around us. And that's something that in my travels, in that I just see that our infrastructures, our models, the things that they're just sorely lacking. They're still stuck in the dark ages or the industrial revolution in many respects. And that infrastructure needs to get up to speed with a sustainable future, with a regenerative future. And so I totally agree with you. What have you learned or experienced in your professional journey so far that, boy, you say, I wish I would have learned that a long time ago, or that I wish I would have known that experience or had that much sooner?
Oh, this is a good one, I guess. Let me think. Leaning into who I am specifically earlier. I wish I had just had the confidence to know and that it was okay just to be me and not to try to live up to other people's standards, ways of doing things, and so on. Really, because the more I do that, the more impactful I am, the more fun I have, the happier I am, and the world around me equally.
Louise, thank you for letting us all inside of your ideas. It's been a sheer pleasure. That's all I have, unless you have something you want to ask me or that you didn't get to say. Now's your chance.
Well, I have a couple of things.
Please, please, please.
So one was, I thought of something. You said I could have two messages. The other one was,
and sure.
It sits a little bit strangely with me because I am a city girl. Like I really am very urban in my upbringing and so on. But I do think that being quiet in nature is a message that I would encourage everybody to just try and have for a while. Just being quiet in nature. And that can be the park or, you know, 2 inches of grass somewhere. This never fails. And to ask you, I would love to ask you what you know, you do so many diverse things, and how you would like, I guess, people to engage with the podcast and this part of your life. You do so much with companies, with the UN, all over, and then you're still taking the time to chat to people like me and to get these ideas out. So what would you like the listeners of the podcast, I guess, to do or to change when they listen to all of them? It doesn't have, not just mine, of course.
So I can tell you a bunch of things. So I'm very, I take a very systems approach to life. Mm-hmm. And I think it's sheer freedom. So a lot of people think, oh boy, that's a lot. Mark does a lot of things and must not ever sleep or whatever. But by taking a systems view approach to life and addressing multiple facets of a what could be called a complex system, not only do you solve more human suffering, but you also start to address global grand challenges. And so why I do the podcast, why I speak and work for the UN, why I work on, you know, future projects or work with companies is because I want to empower global citizens, anyone I can reach, to live an adaptive lifestyle of health and sustainability, to see that there's much more beauty in this world, that there's models that have been around for a long time, that if we apply them and even do them in a systemic or an autonomous way, life just gets better. Again, not only do, yes, the profits become more, but the internal rewards of how your life goes just feels a lot better. And I want them to learn how to live that adaptive lifestyle of health and sustainability within the safe operating spaces of our planetary boundaries. And so the advice that I guess is mainly for the podcast, our brain processes information and language a lot faster than we can speak it. Mm-hmm. So put the podcast on 1.5, 2.0 speed, because I'm a slow talker. I might say, oh, and I'm a lot of time, but the wisdoms of many of those who are on the podcast, you, Louise, John, most are authors, CEOs, thought leaders trying to put us on the right side of history. And those questions that I ask you, specifically the one, what does a world that works for everyone look like for you, has been different from well over 2,800 people that I've asked that question. It's always been different, which is very telling.
Yes.
We're not cooperating. We're not collaborating as much as we should be. We're not always on the same page? Are we all moving in the same direction? Does that diversity help us to reach that goal? I think it's so vital for us to think about that question for ourselves and start to formulate our own local economy, our own world in the way we want to see the future, to the way we think that it'll work, at least at first for us, and then hopefully for everyone else. And then start looking around you, and if those models and the things you're seeing in the world aren't that way, start having conversations, like you said. Let's have those conversations. Let's communicate and let people say, hey, I disagree. Let's be activists. Let's change those policies. Let's try to shape those. Let's change the way our business works so that that outcome, that roadmap, those plans or goals to get there will be the one that we decide. Because if you don't know the answer to those questions, if you've never thought about it, it's most likely that you'll never get to that. Someone else will push you in that direction. You're kind of like a ship without a rudder or without a plan or roadmap.
That's a great answer. Thank you. No,
you're most welcome.
Thank you very much for doing this and all the work you do. And I'm very proud to be included in this bit.
It's been a sure pleasure. It's been a great podcast, and I've really enjoyed it. I'm sure it's going to go really well. Thank you very much, Louise.
Sure, thanks.
Take care. Tell John and everyone hello.
I will do. See you soon.
Bye.